The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The topic for today is some medieval arguments for God's existence, with special reference to St. Anselm, Thomas Aquinas, and John Duns Scotus. And we will, I'll try to say something about how these three thinkers, not only how they argue for God's existence, but how we might think of the relations between their different approaches to offering demonstrations of God's existence. Today happens to be the feast day of St. Anselm, so there's a special appropriateness in having a talk here that has something to do with Anselm. I want to start by saying something about why Catholics ought to care about arguments for God's existence. You know, we believe what the Church teaches. The Church teaches, among other things, that God exists. Why do we need arguments? Moreover, for almost all of us, at least those of us in the room who do believe in God, rarely do religious people like us come to believe in God's existence on the basis of the wonderful arguments that have been offered throughout the centuries. Almost always, we come to believe in God through habituation. You know, we're sort of raised up in it, or we get invited to church and start going to Mass or something, and eventually it sort of clicks. It usually works more like that for people than by studying, say, Anselm's ontological argument, thinking that it's cogent, and just, you know, having a conversion experience that way. So that disconnect between the arguments for God's existence and the way that the arguments seem not to function in the formation of religious belief, I think raises an interesting question about why do them. One, I think, fairly straightforward answer is that even if an argument is unlikely to persuade someone to adopt a religious way of life all on its own, there might be some apologetic help that we can offer people who are, say, agnostic about God, or convert them at least from atheism to agnosticism through a powerful argument for God's existence. So there's an apologetic and therefore evangelistic function, I think, to the arguments for God's existence that have been offered over the centuries. But I also think, and this is nothing original to me, I also think that the arguments for God's existence can be encouraging to religiously committed people. We don't believe in God, we don't adopt a religious way of life because of the arguments, but having so professed belief, having so committed our lives, when we can, as it were, study the reasons that are there behind it all, to the extent that we can access those reasons, it can be encouraging. Like, oh, I'm not deluded. Yeah. Even if, in fact, the arguments themselves are not the grounds of my own commitment. So whether it's an encouragement to believers or an apologetic or evangelistic tool, I think that these classical arguments, classical and contemporary arguments for God's existence, have a role to play in religious life. They're not merely speculative exercises to see what cool things human minds can come up with. Though that side of it is really cool too. I mean, it is fun. There's something fun about the challenge of thinking through whether from facts about the external world or facts about our own thinking, we can somehow build up a chain of reasoning that leads us to something that transcends the universe. The three authors that we're going to be talking about today are arguably the three greatest philosophers of the Middle Ages. There are other names that we could put into that mix, but these are the heavy hitters. Thomas Aquinas, I'm sure everyone here has at least heard of, even if you haven't got around to studying him yet in any of your courses. St. Anselm, just give me a show of hands, I hope no one will be embarrassed, but who has read any St. Anselm before? Show of hands, maybe a little over half, okay. The ontological argument, the so-called ontological argument from his Proslogion, this Proslogion is his most famous book. How many have read that of the readers of, okay, so some people have read Anselm, but not Proslogion, all right. And then our third person, John Duns Scotus, perhaps a distant third in terms of fame, but you can just, I know some of you are studying Scotus in Professor Vader's class, so you know about him. You know all about him now. But for those of you who've never heard this name before, I'll say just a little bit by way of introduction when we get to Scotus's own argument. For any Thomists of strict observance in the room, you may be aware that Aquinas himself had some concerns about an argument like Anselm's argument. So one of the things I'm going to say as we transition from Anselm to Aquinas is how I understand that relationship, how I understand Aquinas's objection working, and to what extent it actually applies to Anselm. Okay, so let's dive in to Anselm. The Proslogion, literally a sort of a speaking to, it's written in the form of a prayer to God. It's addressed to God. And in this prologue, and then especially in this opening chapter, chapter one, he writes about this sense of anxiety or despair, about, on the one hand, his desire for God and his sense that he can only be happy by having a knowledge and deep loving union with God, but then on the other hand, how distant he feels from God, both because he doesn't understand God very well and because he sees in himself his own obstacles through his sinfulness. So he has this in despair. He wants to know God better. He knows that he can only be happy with God. But he's asking God how he can arrive at this deeper understanding and this deeper love of God. He tells us in the prologue of this Proslogion that he had been eagerly looking for a single argument. He wanted a single argument that would lay bare the reasons for faith. Partly he wanted to do this to help his brother monks. And he struggled with coming up with the argument. He couldn't do it. And he says that eventually the argument found him. So he didn't find the argument found him, which is a very interesting way to put it. And he wrote it all down, and then we have the Proslogion. And oftentimes in courses in which you might encounter the argument, it's just excerpted, you know, maybe into a little anthology or a PDF that you see on Canvas, and all you get is chapter 2. It's a short paragraph, it's a long paragraph, but it's a short chapter, and it lays out what we now call the ontological argument. He doesn't call it that. A later philosopher did. It's not a particularly helpful description, but it now functions more like a name. It's just the name of the argument, the ontological argument. The most important premise of this argument is the thought that found Anselm, that God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. And from that thought, not actually original to Anselm, you can find it in Boethius, and you can find it in Augustine, but it was understanding how that thought could lead to a conclusion that God exists. So I want us to think a little bit about this formula. God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. One way of understanding this formula is that we can somehow access what the great making features of a thing are. And we can sort of line them all up and then see which ones are the best. You know, so being made out of gold, that's cool when things are made out of gold. Being wise, that's really cool when things are wise. Can golden things be wise things? Well, no. You know, my wedding ring is really beautiful and it's solid gold, but it's not the kind of thing that can have wisdom. So now we have to say, well, which one is better, gold or being wise? Well, we might not always act like it, but wisdom. Okay, that's the better one. And so this is a really great making feature that a thing can have, being wise. And it's compatible with other really great making features like being loving, being powerful, and so on. And so you might think that what it means to be that than which nothing greater can be conceived is to be the essence that somehow includes all of these perfect, pure perfections, wisdom and love and so on. And you might think that because we can detect value in the world and can make judgments about how some things are better than other things, that we actually have the ability to fill out, perhaps in some detail, what kinds of perfections would belong to such an essence. And if you look at the way that Anselm actually develops the reasoning in Proslogion, I think there is some reason to think that he thinks we can make some headway in that kind of natural way of thinking about pure perfections. But what Anselm actually tells us about this formula, that than which nothing greater can be conceived, is that what he was after was a way of thinking about God that would sort of, in this pithy, logically powerful way, express everything that we believe about the divine nature. Everything that we believe about the divine nature. And by we, he means like we Catholics. So there is, I think, something more to this formula than we often get in just a kind of chalkboard version of the argument. That there's somehow, this is that thinking of God as that than which nothing greater can be conceived is not just some intuition of what God's essence must be like. It's a distillation of what we already know about God from revelation, or perhaps both from revelation and reason together. But I don't think that Anselm's argument should be thought of as solely based on reason alone. I think that he is thinking of this opening premise as something that is given by revelation. And I think that should color the way that we understand the argument. In premise two, if you're looking on the handout, this is some students find this consternating, that than which nothing greater can be conceived exists in the understanding. And so what do you mean God exists in my understanding? It's pretty clear that all this means is that we can form some sort of idea of God, a concept, and that the concept is coherent. So here's something that exists in your understanding. say, like the concept of human being. In the old Aristotelian definition, rational animal. When we put those conceptual pieces together, an animal that has rationality, say, those fit together. The concept of human being is a coherent concept. We also happen to know that they exist, so that helps. Here's something that it does not exist in your understanding. A square circle. Doesn't exist, so I'm just asserting this for you. You might defy me, but the square and circle cannot form a single concept. You have to think one and then think the other, or think them next to each other, or sort of imagine one sort of on top of the other, or something like that. But you can't have a coherent concept of a square circle. There's some sort of contradiction or opposition between the conceptual elements. So when Anselm is asserting here that than which nothing greater can be conceived exists in the understanding, he means to be asserting that the concept of God is coherent. Why might anyone doubt that the concept of God is coherent? Well, here's a reason. A reason that Anselm considers. Justice and mercy seem to be opposed to each other in some way, but God is supposed to be perfectly just and perfectly merciful. So if there is a real opposition between being perfectly just and perfectly merciful, then maybe the concept of God is incoherent. Or if you think that there's something incoherent about the existence of evil and the existence of an all-good, all-powerful being, then you might think, well, something's got to give. Obviously, there's evil, so maybe there's something incoherent about our conception of God. So these are challenges to the coherence of the very idea of God. So Anselm's assertion here, then, is that this is a coherent concept. And then if you've read all of the Proslogion, you might remember that what he does in several chapters of the book is he tries to bring into tension certain divine perfections and show that they really can be together. Justice and mercy is probably the most famous of these examples in the Proslogion. Okay, so we get this description of God, is that than which nothing greater can be conceived, an assertion that the concept of God is coherent. Premise 3, it's greater to exist in reality and in the understanding than in the understanding alone. This one is funny because I think it's obvious, and a lot of people don't think it's obvious at all. But I think that a being that exists, a being like God, is on the whole greater if he exists in reality than if he only exists as a figment of your imagination. We can maybe come back to that in the Q&A. So since God is the greatest conceivable being, and since it's greater to exist in reality than in the understanding alone, and since the concept of God is coherent, Anselm infers that God exists in reality. It's a nice argument, in part because the conclusion has to be that the being whose existence is proved is God. When we get to Aquinas' argument in just a minute, there's this perennial question about how to understand the five ways, right? When we get to the conclusion of the second way, there's a first efficient cause, itself uncaused, and this everyone says is God. Do we? Yeah. Or don't we need to show a lot more about this first efficient cause in order to know that it's God? I myself am not particularly bothered by that in Aquinas. I don't think you should be either. But there's something tidy about Anselm's argument because it begins with a description of a being that could only be God, and so proves the existence of that being. All right, now when Aquinas is writing, not the five ways themselves, but before he gets to the five ways, and he asks, can God's existence be proved? Is God's existence self-evident? And when he says that God's existence is not self-evident to us, he talks about an argument that kind of looks like Anselm's argument. And so it's pretty standard for Thomists to say that Aquinas rejects Anselm's argument. What Aquinas is objecting to is the idea that that the existence of God is somehow self-evident to us. And the reason why Anselm's argument gets associated with self-evidence, you might think, Anselm's argument doesn't look self-evident to me. But the idea is that if you just start with the claim that what it is to be God is to be that than which nothing greater can be conceived, and if it simply follows from the concept, just by the meaning of the words, that such a being must exist, that's what Aquinas means by self-evidence. Not that you just see it, and as soon as you see it, you understand it perfectly. But that simply from the meaning of the terms involved, we can derive the conclusion. Now notice that Anselm's own argument, in his own words, I'm not so sure that he thought that it was self-evident that God exists in that sense. Remember what I said about this formula, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. It's supposed to express everything that we believe about the divine nature. That's what Anselm says. So I'm not sure that it's supposed to be self-evident to Anselm that this is what God is. Interpreters of Anselm in the 13th century did eventually think of Anselm's argument like this. So I think Aquinas is actually responding more to 13th century formulations of Anselm's argument and the way that they themselves understood it than Anselm himself. So there might be some room for Anselmians and Thomists to hold hands on the topic of God's existence, that we might have a plurality of powerful arguments here that a Thomist could appreciate in Anselm and Anselm in Aquinas. I want to highlight, finally, before moving on to Aquinas, that whether we think of this formula in premise one as something that we can intuit by our own powers of reason, or whether it's something that we need to have revealed to us, whatever we think about that, there is something that is interior about this argument. It's mental. It's starting from a kind of verbal formula and concluding to the existence of God simply from what must follow from that formula. Again, where we get the formula is a different sort of question. This is an interior kind of argument. We're not looking out in the world. We're inspecting our concepts. This is a very Augustinian sort of theme in Anselm. It runs throughout Anselm, but Augustine always encourages us to look inward. We find God by looking within, not necessarily by looking out. So I just want to highlight that, because in Aquinas we get a very outward way of approaching the demonstration of God's existence. So this is a kind of heuristically enlarged version of the second way that I've offered here. And I don't want to talk through every single premise, but if we focus on the way that the argument begins, some things come into existence. So it's about contingent facts out there in the world. This is something that we can observe. You know, some people might object, well, if the fundamental reality is just particles and they don't come into existence, then maybe like the things that seem like they come into existence, like you and me and artifacts and other kinds of life forms, We talk about the world that way, but maybe that's not the fundamental reality. So if you want to do that sort of reductionistic sort of program that some scientific philosophers hope to do, then maybe you would have some reason to doubt this opening premise of Aquinas' argument. It's meant to be evident, highly evident to us, that some things begin to exist. It's like a common feature of our experience of the world. So then we build in certain kinds of sort of axioms about coming into existence. The things that come into existence have a cause of their existence. You can't just pop into existence. Things that begin to exist can't cause themselves. Things that begin to exist, you can't have a circle of causes where you end up having one thing causing itself. Things that begin to exist can't have an infinite series of causes. And if you accept all of these sort of causal axioms, which seem almost as evident to the our sort of philosophical intuition as that things come into existence is evident to our senses, then you have the makings of a really powerful argument for God's existence. This second way is one example of a type of argument that is often called a cosmological argument. Cosmological has something to do with the way the universe is. That sort of adverts to that exterior aspect that I was just mentioning. So cosmological alongside, or sometimes versus, ontological arguments. I want to say something briefly about the causal series here. Aquinas makes a really important distinction when he's arguing that we can't have an infinite series of causes, that the series has got to stop somewhere at a first cause that isn't caused. He concedes the possibility that you could have a situation where A causes B, and then, you know, maybe A dies or something like that, and then B causes C, and then sometime later C causes D, and so on and so forth. That sort of causal series, Aquinas thinks, yeah, maybe that could go on forever. Forever in the past, forever into the future. The kind of causal series that he thinks can't go on forever is the sort of series that you have when at the moment A is causing B, A is dependent on something else for its existence and activity. And if A weren't, A is not acting as a first cause. A is not supplying all that needs to be in place in order for A to cause B. So A is reliant on prior causes at the very moment of its causing B. And so whatever that is, it itself is reliant on its causing, the causing of A, on something higher up still. Aquinas calls this an essentially ordered series of causes. And the idea is that it's all the causal series is in place at a single moment of causing. It's not a series that stretches back into time. So that's the kind of series that Aquinas thinks, in order for any coming into existence to happen, we have to have this chain of causes at the moment of the causing that must terminate in a first cause. Thinking now about Duns Scotus, I think of Duns Scotus's argument as incorporating elements of both Anselm and Aquinas. Duns Scotus was a Franciscan thinker, lived a generation after Aquinas. He read Aquinas because of the topic of analogical versus univocal language about God, because they took ostensibly different positions on that question. They're often read as opponents to each other. But in fact, although Scotus read a lot of Aquinas and sometimes expressed disagreement with him, It's not as though Aquinas were Scotus's foil, or that he was the guy he was constantly working against, or reading and then criticizing. Scotus appreciated Aquinas, but didn't. Aquinas was not his main thing. One of Scotus's main interlocutors was a guy named Henry of Ghent, who borrowed heavily from Aquinas in the development of his own arguments for God's existence. I think that what Scotus is doing is taking the kind of structure of of Aquinas's five ways, some of the other arguments that were kind of in the waters in the Franciscan intellectual circles that Henry of Ghent also tries to synthesize a bit. And Scotus is especially interested in Anselm himself, and I think must have read the Proslogion. He's trying to bring these together into a single system. And what I'm going to, what I have here is sometimes called the coloring, the coloratio of Anselm's argument. Duns Scotus, as he is working in his own arguments for God's existence, he gets to a point where he turns to Anselm and he says, we can improve on Anselm's argument. And the word for improvement is coloratio, which is literally like coloring or enhancing. So what is that improvement? Well, I think it has something to do with Scotus's recognition that the cosmological, causal argument, like we find in Aquinas, is really, really powerful. I think of it as a hybrid, like if you can bring the ontological side of the argument in with the cosmological side, maybe you get an extra strong argument or something like that. But one thing that Scotus tweaked with regard to Aquinas's argument is that whereas Aquinas starts with something in fact has come into existence, it's evident that something begins to exist, Scotus starts with a metaphysical premise. Something can begin to exist. Something can begin to exist. And the reason he wanted to start there, something can begin to exist rather than something has begun to exist, is that he thought that it is a contingent fact about reality that anything has begun to exist. Imagine, it's a little bit crude maybe, but like not very refined, but imagine God had decided never to make a world at all. Like what would reality be like if God had never made a world at all? Well, it'd just be God. That's all there would be. But God doesn't come into existence. So in such a world, nothing comes into existence. So it's not a necessary fact about being as such. It's not a necessary fact about reality that something has come into existence. But it is a necessary fact about reality that something can come into existence. Because in our imaginary state of affairs where it's only God, it's still the case that God has all of the power that he has in this world in which he has in fact created something. So it's still the case in that state of affairs that something can come into existence, even if nothing ever does. Scotus latched onto that idea, and he thought that it gets the argument for God off on a stronger foot because it starts from a necessary premise rather than a contingent premise. And it seems at least as evident, if not more, than Aquinas' contingent premise. So there's this shift from what you might think of as a physical premise, something out there in the physical world begins to exist, to a metaphysical premise. But if something can exist, it follows that something, if something can begin to exist, it follows that something can cause something to exist. Because for the same sorts of reasons we saw in Aquinas, nothing can cause itself to exist. So If something can come into existence, we know that it can't cause itself, so it must be the case that there is something that, it must be the case that some, must be true that something can cause another thing to exist. But then, just as in Aquinas, we don't want an infinite series of causes, so here too, when we're just considering being as such, the idea of a infinite series of causable causers is incoherent, according to Scotus, and so we get to the existence of a first cause that way. But then here now, in the text that we have a sort of application of that earlier, more elaborate argument. Here, Scotus is asserting that it is possible that a first cause of every causable thing exists. Right? So a first cause of everything causable can exist. It's just this an assertion of the possibility of the existence of such a thing, not the actuality yet. Now, why would we think that? For similar reasons to those discussed in Anselm, there's a kind of coherence to the concept of a first cause of everything causable. Getting into the weeds a little bit here, sometimes people, when they hear Aquinas' premise that you can't have an infinite series of causes, they say, well, why? I don't quite see it. Like, why? Scotus offers several reasons, one of which is simply this. It's possible that there is not an infinite series of causes. It's possible that there is a first cause that terminates every essentially ordered causal series. But now, if that is the most perfect possible way of being a cause, and if that than which nothing greater can be conceived is going to have causality in the most perfect possible way, well, then we can infer from the possibility that there's not an infinite regress of caused causes to the actuality that there's not. Why? Because there's the greatest conceivable being who has causality in the most perfect way. So that's kind of nice. All right, but here in this our version of the argument, we have premise one, the assertion of the possibility of a first cause of everything causable. Nothing can cause itself to exist. Since this thing is a first cause, uncaused, and can't cause itself, it cannot be caused to exist, because it can't cause itself and nothing else is prior to it. But then it follows, premise four, that such a being or such a nature, if it doesn't exist, it can't exist. If it doesn't exist, it can't exist. Because if it doesn't exist, there's no way that it can come into existence, being what it is. All right, so now, premise five, assume for a reductio ad absurdum, you know, we're going to derive a contradiction. Assume that this being does not exist. So it follows, number six, that it can't exist. It would follow in our reductio that such a being can't exist, but it can exist. But then premise seven is basically just repeating number one, such a being can exist. So we have our contradiction. Right? So something's got to give. Either we hold one in place, we continue to assert the possibility that such a nature can exist, or we have to not only deny its actual existence, but deny even its possibility. We have to pick. And Scotus thinks we're on much solider ground by asserting the bare possibility of such a nature. But the happy result is that in asserting the possibility of such a nature, we can derive that it must exist in fact. Because if it turned out that it didn't exist, it couldn't exist, and so wouldn't be possible. But it is possible, ergo. So why think that it's possible? I mentioned the Anselmian reasons. Scotus himself says, right around this text that I excerpted, that when we consider the divine attributes, we find no contradiction. There's a sort of intellectual rest. There's an analogy here that Scotus draws. It's a nice analogy. The ear, our sense of hearing, it's really good at picking out discordant music. Wouldn't it be funny if our intellect, which is stands to being itself as the ear stands to sound, wouldn't it be funny if our intellect wasn't really good at picking out contradiction in being? So now Scotus not realizing how far advanced of the rest of us that he is. You know, he's really good at it, but does that mean we are? But nevertheless, he thinks that in contemplating the divine attributes, including being first cause and being uncausable, that we can detect no contradiction. And where we detect no contradiction, we ought to assert possibility. So that's sort of his own defense of that premise one. All right, so compare and contrast. Like Aquinas, Scotus is very interested in causal arguments. No infinite regresses, nothing can be the cause of itself. Unlike Aquinas, he wants to move these causal premises from being about contingent states of affairs in the actual world to the very possibility that we can detect among being. It's just built into the nature of being that something can exist, and that holds whether or not God has in fact made anything. So that's a tweak of Aquinas. Notice, this is not a rejection of Aquinas' premise. It's just a new premise inspired by Aquinas. Good arguments love company. Now, in making that metaphysical move, Scotus is asking us to think about the nature of being itself, which we access intellectually, or conceptually, rather than empirically. And in that respect, Scotus' argument is a lot like Anselm's. It's that interior move again. But it's an interior, sort of interior-oriented argument that has these causal premises inspired by Aquinas. And those are some of the reasons why I think of Scotus as a nice kind of bridge or hybrid between Anselm and Aquinas on the topic of arguments for God's existence. So I'll pause there because I'm eager to get into Q&A, and I hope we have a lot of time for that. So thank you for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.